For those of you who don't know him, this is Dr. Dan Brown, who is currently working through Harvard Medical School on research on the psychology of meditation and development of meditation from a psychological point of view. He has been a student both of Western psychology and also of Buddhism for many years, having done his doctorate thesis on Tibetan Buddhism and studied for a long time with Geshe Wangyal, a respected Tibetan Lama in New Jersey. And for the last several years, he, in conjunction with several other psychologists and friends, has been collecting data from various kinds of measures and tests here at the Insight Meditation Society on students who've been doing practice over the 3-month course and other longer retreat periods. Dan.
Thanks, Jay. Someone raised the question about 15 minutes ago in terms of how long this talk would be. And we talked about maybe an hour, but with the heat of the lights, I think we'll probably melt in 15 minutes, so maybe that's how long the talk will be. Anyhow, let me begin by saying something about the reason we're trying to do this research. I think it's obvious from the blessed presence that we have of Mahasi Sayadaw and the other monks and Munindra and all of the other teachers who are now at the center, that it's really an auspicious time, and it really does seem to fit in with the Buddhist prophecies about that this is really the time for Buddhism to come to the West. It's really a very auspicious occasion, I think, that we have the teachers coming now. And yet there are problems that are maybe not accounted for in the movement of the Dharma to the West. It's a different culture, people have different capacities, people think somewhat differently. And that part of the motivation for wanting to do this research is to learn more about the different ways that we have of our own culture and how the teachings can be more effectively utilized, I think, here. In our own culture, in psychology, at least in clinical psychology and psychiatry, the whole reason for that kind of treatment is really for the removal of human suffering, particularly mental pain, mental suffering. Buddhism, likewise, is a way, a very old way, to help remove suffering. I think most psychologists in this country and psychiatrists, doctors, don't really grasp yet the value of Buddhism for the removal of suffering. If you look at the literature, the research literature on meditation, because meditation, as you know, is very faddish now in this country, most of the literature has to do with stress reduction, that meditation helps you relax. It helps you relax your muscles. It helps you get a stable mentation pattern, which means that you have your brain waves come forth more rhythmically, slow waves like alpha waves, theta waves, things like that. And then all of that means that your body and mind is more relaxed but alert. But with the hundreds and hundreds of papers that have come out on meditation in this country in the last couple of years, to look at meditation primarily in terms of stress reduction, I think, misses the point. It doesn't really get at what the heart of Buddhist meditation practice is, which is really, as far as I'm concerned, to remove human suffering. And that the reason for doing the practice of mindfulness, for example, is really to help you root out the hindrances. That kind of teaching, and as being the heart of the teaching, I think, is not grasped at all by psychologists who might use meditation as a way of teaching people to just relax. So that what we thought of is starting a whole different kind of research, really first by not just bringing people into the laboratory and finding out what the brain waves are like, but finding out what the tradition itself says about the practice and what its value is. And that's come in a number of stages. For me, it's meant my own training was with the Tibetan Mahayana, with Geshe Wangyal, learning the practice orally, learning the languages, and finding out what my teachers and also the texts say about what Buddhist Mahayana practice does. I think for Jack, if I can speak for you for a minute, Jack, with your book on the Living Masters, it means going and not only doing the practice yourself, but being with masters and authorities on the tradition and letting them speak for themselves in terms of what the teaching is about and what it represents. And I think only when we first hear what the teaching is about, then can we think about doing research on it, not only hearing it, but also practicing it ourselves. Coming in from an outsider, you often miss the point of what it's about, I think. In addition to learning what the tradition says through its masters and through its written documents, one of the other things that I think we've been interested in doing is finding out what contemporary people in this culture experience, and also in South Asia, as they are beginning students. For Jack, it meant on your dissertation, interviewing people who come to these kind of retreats and then writing about the kinds of experiences that they go through. For Jack Engler, who I wish also was here today, it meant interviewing people and giving people questionnaires about the kind of experiences that they commonly have when they're beginning students. Because one of the things that happens when you read the texts about meditation is the texts are weighted more towards the advanced stages. A good example of that, for example, Mahasi Sayadaw's Progress of Insight. The weighting of that book is for people who can grasp the insights and do very advanced kind of meditations. Although it doesn't write a lot, that particular book doesn't write a lot about the beginner's experience. And I think that the beginner's experience is really the most complicated and hardest to understand. And that it's more complicated by the fact that we're beginners in another culture than how these things were traditionally taught, and there are other problems that come up around that. So part of the reason of studying and observing people as they go through 2-week, 3-month retreats here is to learn what happens to beginners. I think I would include all of us as beginners. What happens over the weeks and months? What sort of things come up in our mind? What we observe? And what kind of insights come out of that? And what are the obstructions that come up? And what might we keep track of that might help improve the transmission of this and the teaching of this by way of the kind of obstructions that come up more for people in this culture? So that's what I think one of the motivations is. The other is not so much to look at what happens to people who are already committed to the practice as beginners, but what about people who have no knowledge and don't hear anything about Buddhist teachings in this country? Specifically, I mean the psychologists, the physicians, psychiatrists. We have a whole tradition of healing in this country, or several traditions, around the removal of human suffering, and yet there's absolutely no knowledge of many hundreds of years of Buddhism, which is a tradition to remove suffering. So I think that one of the things that would be valuable is to let Western healers, psychiatrists, physicians, psychologists, learn more about a whole other tradition for removal of suffering, namely Buddhism. But they're not likely to read about Buddhism, they're not likely to pick up books on Buddhism, unless you can show some way that it's valuable to them within their own terms. And that's where I think the research comes in. They understand research language, and they can see results if presented in a certain kind of way. Now, you know from your own practice that when you do the meditation, the insights that you get are self-evident. Now, you can see with your own, in yourself, what happens from it. Yet there has to be another way of presenting the material to people who won't ever get to the point of practice. And that's what I think the research can do. I think that practice itself is the most valuable tool for people to learn about the value of Buddhism. But unless you give people some sort of format to understand the practice, they won't ever get to that stage. But people can pick up the research reports and say, my God, this looks like it works for some reason. Maybe I'll come and try that. A good example of that was the 3-day course that Sharon did last February, where a lot of clinicians can't take 2 weeks off to do this kind of course. It's just alien to them to think about rearranging patient schedule and getting coverage for 2 weeks. It's just too hard. But they could come for a weekend, and it means some modification of maybe the way things are taught here to make it available to people who wouldn't normally come but might get a lot of value out of it. And a lot of clinicians came that weekend and found it very valuable, and now since they can see the value, will come back for the two-week courses and make it as a priority. So that you have to kind of think about how to present this in a way that can be within people's understanding and their worldview according to their capacity. And research can be useful, I think, for some people and not for others, you know, as in any kind of means that you use to present the teachings. We have done research particularly on students at Barry for about 4 years now. We've tended to focus more on the three-month students, largely as a way of finding out what happens in intensive practice. When people practice 10, 16 hours a day for 3 months, you have more an opportunity to find out what really happens in meditation than the kind of studies that are published in the literature all the time, which means, you know, like the transcendental meditation approaches to teach you to meditate 20 minutes a day, twice a day, for however long. And a lot of the research that's published now is on TM and other forms like that. And it's usually doing practice for no more than 20 minutes or an hour a day for 2 weeks or something like that. It's not very intensive. So the findings reported in the literature don't really get at, again, the heart of the practice. And that's why I think we decided to work more with the long-term meditators. First year we did that, we worked with a lot of what in psychology are called paper and pencil tests, or just things that you fill out. Tests about emotions, for example, tests about what happens to your experience of anxiety, what happens to your experience of emotions. In addition, we gave out attitude tests. What about your attitude towards death, your own death? How much you're afraid of it, how much you accept it, how you view it, your whole view of the world and your own life. We gave out tests that measure different kinds of everyday behavior, like what about habits, you know, like smoking cigarettes or watching TV, or the kind of food you eat, how much sleep you get, all these kind of daily habits. We wanted to know how the practice affects all of these things. Okay. Well, one of the things that we found, if you give these tests before and after, you learn something about the effect over the 3 months. We found, and it's been reported in other laboratories, that people who meditate here for two weeks and then 3 months, at first report a great increase in the amount of anxiety that they have for the first week or two of the practice. And then after that, the amount of anxiety that they subjectively experience decreases significantly and much below what they experienced before they ever came to do any meditation at all. And it seems that if you do a follow-up a year later and you give them the same tests, they still report some decrease in their overall amount of anxiety. So it's clear that the practice has an effect on the kind of things that make you nervous in your daily life. And other people have reported the same thing, so that's something that's pretty well established now. If you talk about specific emotions rather than anxiety, there are these, you ever see these adjective checklists? Some of you who've been subjects in this research know that. You can have an adjective checklist with maybe 100 different kinds of words for emotions, and you check off which apply to you in your current experience. And you can give these to people over time in the course of their sitting. But one of the things you find is that people tend to report a greater variety of experience of emotions after they've done the mindfulness practice than before. They're more in touch with their feelings. And the feelings are experienced with greater intensity, and they're also more labile, means they turn them over all of the time. So if you watch what happens to people's experience of their emotional life over the course of several months, usually they get more in touch with their emotions, and they're less problematic, which is interesting. Most people in this culture, for cultural reasons, are out of touch with their emotional life to any great degree. But the more you turn inward and focus your attention in a particular way, that is, focusing mindfully on the mental content, what you find is that you get more, you watch the emotions come up much more. But you do it in a less involved, less judgmental way. And the research does seem to bear that out. We've tried to do this several different ways, you know, by giving these adjective checklists, and we've also had questionnaires and interviews, and no matter what way you look at it, and that's one of the things you want to do in research, is to come up with different ways of looking at the same thing. And if all of the different instruments that you use to look at something all say the same thing, you call it valid. It's not an error in the way that you've tried to collect the research or the instruments that you're using. Another thing that we looked at that early year was people's view of the world and view of themselves. Most people have a philosophy of life, if you will. And there is a test that we gave out that year that was kind of interesting. It's called the Ways to Live. It's a test of your worldview. Here it is. And on this little sheet, some of you might have seen it, many of you will have not, there are 13 descriptions of a lifestyle. And you're to list them in order of preference, which ones you like, which ones you don't like. And we gave that before, we gave that after the 3 months, and we gave that a year later, to see if the practice, and not, by practice I don't just mean the practice of the mindfulness, but the whole package, the mindfulness and the Dharma talks and living this kind of lifestyle. Does it really affect in any way people's view of the world in their own lives? The 13 ways that are on this, I'll just list them. One of the ways has to do with preserving the best that man has attained. The second is valuing independence of persons and things. The third way is sympathetic concern for others. The fourth is experiencing festivity and solitude and alteration. The fifth is enjoying life through adherence to the collectivity, getting involved in the group. Being part of a movement. The next is constantly mastering the change of life's conditions. The seventh is integrating action, enjoyment, and contemplation into a balanced view of life. The eighth is simply enjoying life. The ninth is quietly being receptive for whatever comes next in life. The tenth is stoic self-control and self-mastery. The 11th is contemplating the inner life. The 12th is adventure. And the 13th is following some cosmic law. And these ways were drawn up from values found in a lot of the world's great religions, but put in a kind of culture-free way, common sense terms, in terms of little descriptions. And then people read it and they try and find out which one of those they like and which ones they don't like, and it's, you rate it from 1 to 7. I like it very much is 7, and I don't like it at all, I don't like it very much, is 1. And they go through and they rate them, and then they have to rank them. They take all 13 and they find out which one they like the best. And you find out whether or not there's any consistency over the 3 months. And it turns out there's a striking amount of consistency after the 3 months, but not before. So that whatever happens in the 3 months of sitting here, there is some coherence of a worldview that comes out. And there are three of these that were checked off the year that we did this study. The one that was adhered to most commonly interestingly enough was number 3. I'll read it to you. This way of life makes central the sympathetic concern for other persons. Affection should be made the main thing of life. Affection that is free from all traces of imposition of oneself upon others, or of using others for one's own purpose. Greed in possessions, emphasis on sexual passion, the search for power over persons and things, excessive emphasis on intellect, undue concern for oneself are to be avoided. For these themes hinder the sympathetic love amongst persons, which alone gives significance to life. If we are aggressive, we block our receptivity to the personal forces upon which we are dependent for genuine personal growth. One should accordingly purify oneself, restrain from self-assertiveness, become receptive, appreciative, and helpful with respect to other persons. This was the view out of the 13 that was most adopted by the meditators after 3 months, and it was quite significant, which means that 85% of the people who went on that retreat found this to be the one that they favored the most. The one that they disliked the most, 86% disliked this, was way number 5, which is act and enjoy life through adherence to the collectivity. Okay? A person should not hold onto himself, withdraw from people, and keep aloof and self-centered. Rather, he should merge oneself with the social group, enjoy cooperation and companionship, join with others in resolute activity for the realization of common goals. Persons are social and persons are active. Life should merge energetic group activity and cooperative group enjoyment. Meditation, restraint, concern for one's self-sufficiency, abstract intellectuality, solitude, stress on one's possessions, all cut the roots which bind persons together. One should live outwardly with gusto, enjoying the good things of life, working with others to secure the things which make possible a pleasant and energetic social life. Those who oppose this ideal are not to be dealt with too tenderly. Life cannot be too fastidious. Now, what was surprising about the findings is that several of these ways really were geared towards meditative traditions. And they weren't the ones that were adopted by the yogis who came out after the 3 months. What people valued more than the meditation was really some sort of concern for self and others. Okay? And the first one I just mentioned was really sympathetic concern for others. The other way that was adopted significantly by the yogis was admitting the diversity of life and accepting all of the relativity of life, but being able to integrate activity, meditation, and simple enjoyment of life together in some balance. Now that way of life is very similar to what's described as equanimity, paksha, in the Buddhist teachings. And the first one, sympathetic concern for others, has some similarities with the notion of metta, loving kindness, friendliness. And the third way that was significantly adopted by the yogis in the 3 month course was wholesome, carefree enjoyment of life, simple enjoyment of the value of life, okay? And particularly value in the man's accomplishments, okay? Now that has some overlap with the concept of joy, mudita, in Buddhism. So you can see here that coming and doing the teachings for 3 months really does affect your view of the world, and that view is like the four immeasurables. Equanimity, loving kindness, joy, compassion wasn't on the list. There's nothing of this like, nothing about karuna or compassion on this list. But the other three were clearly represented. And assertiveness at the expense of others, and going along with group norms simply for being part of the group, were the kind of things that people really did not value at all after going through this kind of training. Okay. Now, there's been a lot of research on this particular test called the Ways to Live, and it's been given to mental patients. And it turns out that mental patients, as opposed to people who seem to be normal and healthy and functional, mental patients don't have a consistent value system. They read these things and they check off all sorts of them, but there's no particular tendency or direction in the way that they look at these. But normal people usually will come up with one or two that they really like and a lot of others they don't like, and then a lot of others that they feel sort of neutral about. So if you take the amount of consistency in holding a worldview as a sign of psychological health, then it does seem that people leave the retreat after going through the practice and the teachings with some better notion of a consistent view of how they're going to organize their life. And they put it into practice. We've done a lot of tests like that, a lot of measures about changes in values, attitudes, emotions, so forth and so on. I'm not going to go into the detail. We've given many of them, and many of you have taken them, so you know a little bit about what they're like. we've tended to emphasize those kind of tests for a particular reason. And it's been my concern that meditation in this country is very faddish. You know, everyone wants to meditate now. But people think of meditation in terms of sitting or hitting the pillow. You know, and they don't set the proper foundations. You know, one of the things that isn't talked about a lot, although all of the talk by people in this country about meditation now, is Shila, the moral training that sets the foundations for the practice. And the view that you take of life, the virtuous and unvirtuous mental factors, your awareness of those, the cultivation of virtuous mental factors, the eradication of unvirtuous mental factors, those kind of things really set the foundations for the practice, so that we've given a lot of these tests to find out what really happens to people in terms of getting those foundations. Because I think that they're necessary in terms of making progress in the practice itself. And then we've done some, for example, ratings of how fast people seem to get insight and how fast they're able to master mindfulness as a method. And that the people who come with more psychological problems and spend some time getting the foundations tend to progress faster than people who come and spend all of the time in the sitting going through whatever their problems are, and just working them over and working them over and working them over, but not getting so far with those. So there's something here about setting the foundations first before trying to do a lot of the more advanced kind of meditations. Now, another thing that we did was to try and find out the kind of common experiences that people have when they meditate. If you take a group of beginners who sit for 3 months, 16 hours a day for 3 months, do they all go through the same thing? They all get the same instructions? Or do they have different kinds of experiences? Well, both of those questions turn out to be true. In a sense, people all have around the same kind of experiences. And in a sense, people all have unique experiences. So the way to measure that, we put together this questionnaire, which a number of you have seen, which is the profile of meditation experience. It's rather long, as you know. It takes many hours to do. You probably all cursed it many times going through it. It's about 600 questions, which is a real lot. It was put together a number of ways, reading through the text and finding out the common descriptions of people's experiences. Finding out through interviews that Jack did the kind of experiences that people commonly reported in the interviews in 2-week courses and in 3-month courses. It's been corrected a number of times by yogis who've taken it and scribbled on it and said this question doesn't make sense, or that why don't you also include this. So that we've gone through a number of revisions and we think we need a number more. One of the revisions, of course, is to cut it down a lot, find out which questions really do represent the nature of the practice. It was designed for a number of meditative traditions and not simply mindfulness here. We've given it to practitioners of Kundalini Yoga. We've given it to people who simply watch the breath and do concentration on the breath, like the Anapana here. We've given it to people who just do concentration on mantras. This is the only population that we've given it to who really do the sati, or the mindfulness practice. So the questionnaire is designed to find out whether or not there are different styles of meditation and whether people have different kinds of experiences with different instructions, which does seem to be the case. The other thing that the questionnaire is designed to do is to find out something about the level of experience that a person is having within a certain tradition. Like, there are certain questions on here that are not readily intelligible unless you've had the experiences. Some of them are not intelligible because maybe the question is poorly worded. But some of them seem to be only intelligible to certain people. For example, access. Very few people, unless they're very experienced, would have something like an access experience. The questions about access here are not readily intelligible, so that most people don't answer them. Every year we find several people who answer those kind of questions. And they're usually the same people that the teachers think independently have those experiences. So there's some correlation here between what people themselves answer on a questionnaire, their own self-report, you see, and what the teachers say about where they are in their practice. So you can, by doing it that way and looking at it two different both from self-reports and from teacher evaluations, you can find out what people have what kind of experiences and who seems to be where in their level of practice. And some of the questions really do seem to be key questions and indicate some advancement in the practice, where those same questions would be not answered or not readily intelligible to people who have not had the experiences. Let me go through for a minute some of the kinds of experiences that people have. We've given this questionnaire over 3 years, and there's all sorts of stuff that I could talk about it. But I just want to say a little bit about what the questionnaire measures and what we're finding. The first part of the questionnaire has to do with how people use their attention. The first 9 questions are about concentration. For example, in your current meditation practice, do you use the approach of fixing your attention on one internal or external object only, like the breath or the mantra or so forth and so on? People who do breath watching or people who do concentrative forms like with a mantra or meditate on the chakras usually always answer that question. This question's a scale: never, rarely, sometimes, often, usually, or always. So you find out the frequency at which people have these kind of experiences. People who do concentrative meditation say that they usually, often, usually, or always focus on one object. People, when they come to Barry, say that they do that sometimes, or usually, or often. But only about 50% of the people who come to a 3-month course do that. Okay. Now, it turns out that of that 50%, most are women. The implication being that women are much better concentrators than men are, at least the ones who come to Barry. Now, there doesn't seem to be any male-female differences in the practice of mindfulness. And the question to illustrate that one is, in your current meditative practice, you use the approach of expanding your attention to different bodily and or mental events as they occur, that is, bodily sensations, thoughts, or feelings. That's the key question for mindfulness. Now, of the 3 years we've given this questionnaire out, 95 to 100% of the people here after 3 months report that that's what they do. That doesn't say very much about the practice. It says the questionnaire really does measure that, okay? Everyone does that. But interestingly enough, the next question was, do you attend to one kind of bodily and mental event only, or do you attend to many or different kinds of bodily and mental events as possible? And there was a real split. Some people tend to focus on one kind of mental content, like thoughts, like sensations. And although they're aware of all the others, those seem to come up more for them. Other people tend to get the whole range. Thoughts, emotions, sensations, intentions, whatever else, or feeling states, whatever. So there are real individual differences in how that's experienced. Most people develop some skill in doing this over the 3 months. And I'll just pick out some of the questions that the criterion here is that 2/3 of the people have to answer this as often, usually, or always, which means it applies to practically everyone who comes here after 3 months. So we're picking out here the common experiences that people have. There's about 50 questions about different kinds of thinking processes. For example, how much you anticipate things. Do you sit in your meditation practice and wonder about what the meal's going to be next, or what you're going to do a week from now? Do you think of some goal to the meditation? Do you think that you're going to get enlightened? So forth and so on. Do you plan things ahead of time? Most of anticipatory and planning thinking really decreases a great deal the longer one sits. So that after 3 months, roughly 80 to 90% of the people claim that they're planning and anticipating things while they were meditating just was not important. It came up every now and then, but generally just wasn't very important. Then there were a lot of questions about worry and concern. Are you afraid that you're going to go insane when you meditate? Are you afraid you won't come out of the meditation? Are you afraid you won't be able to stop the restless mind states? Do you dread having to meditate again? These kind of questions about worry and concern significantly decreased. So that although they reported sometimes, about 100%, just short of 100% of the population said that they no longer were concerned very much about those worries. Okay, so there is something about simply doing the mindfulness that affects hindrances such as doubt. Okay, and when everyone in the population says that, it really does seem to say something about the results of the practice. Then there were a lot of questions about thinking, reasoning, abstract thinking, intellectual thoughts, things like that. Some people tend to continue to do that a lot, and they would be thinking types by nature. But overall, thinking is not something that happens a lot after the 3 months. People report less disturbances by thinking across the board. Okay, even if you're by nature tend to be a thinker, you still know that there are times when there are a lot of thoughts coming up in your mind, but they tend not to bother you as much. You can still practice the mindfulness. And that was a surprising finding, to find the extent to which people don't think when they meditate. And I think it's valuable to Westerners, because a lot of Westerners who don't know anything about meditation have the common sense notion that when you meditate, you're reflecting and thinking on things. And it's very clear from the research that people don't think when they meditate. What they do instead is pay attention. People at times will report spontaneous memories coming up, things about personal life events, and they'll happen rather suddenly. But overall, that doesn't happen very often in the 3 months of meditation. And in fact, if you compare the amount of practice doing mindfulness to the amount of practice doing something like self-hypnosis, because we've studied that in the laboratory, people in self-hypnosis report that they're constantly coming up with events from their life, and they're usually very emotional events. That doesn't happen as much in the mindfulness practice. They come up every now and then, and you just kind of look at them, and then they go away. And there's not this quality of really getting into a lot of your own past experiences. It just comes and goes. And that was a significant difference comparing mindfulness meditators to people who were practicing hour for hour the same amount of self-hypnosis. Imagery. Having vivid images, visual images or auditory images. What we found is that visual images were more individualistic and dependent on personality type rather than the practice itself. Some people had natural propensities towards imagery and they tended to experience a lot throughout the mindfulness. Other people didn't have very much at all. It didn't have anything to do with the instructions as much as individual characteristics coming into the practice. Bodily sensations. A remarkable finding that was 100% of the people reported increased awareness of bodily sensations, awareness of their posture, and subtle movements within their muscles over the course of the 3 months of practice. And that most people prior to the retreat reported practically none of this, so the findings are very significant. Most people are not aware of bodily sensations in this culture. But one of the first things they get aware of in a rather profound way when they do the mindfulness is the bodily sensations. And they report that more than thoughts and feelings, intentions, and whatever else, at least for the people who come here. Interestingly enough, that there's about 20 or 30 questions on bodily sensations that are given here, and we do it by a method called factor analysis, which means you group together the kinds of bodily sensations that are written on this questionnaire, but they're all mixed up. Some of them have to do with psychosomatic complaints, like having headaches, twitches in the muscles, things like that, various pains. Those kind of sensations people report much less of in the general population over time. What they report more of is pain in all sorts of all sorts of varieties of pain and all sorts of intensities of pain located in various parts of the body. But the quality of the experience of the pain is very different, and it becomes interesting and tolerable rather than something that they want to avoid much more. Now that has implications, I think, for clinicians in this culture in terms of simple awareness in a mindful way of the bodily sensations tends to decrease somatic complaints, psychosomatic complaints. And although it hasn't been tried, I wonder what it would mean to teach mindfulness to a clinical population of people who have somatic complaints. I think it'd be a good thing to try at some point. I hope someone does. As we this questionnaire also finds out about what people experience with their emotions, and people are able to articulate very specific emotions and a great variety of emotions over the course of the 3 months. Now, interestingly, the same questionnaire given to concentrators, like people who do mantras, they don't experience a lot of emotions. What the people who concentrate experience is simple, what in psychology is called hedonic tone, or what is translated in Buddhism is feeling. Simple pleasantness, unpleasantness, neutrality, okay, irrespective of the content. And people who do concentrative meditations, like on a mantra, tend to just get the simple feeling tone, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. Whereas people who do the mindfulness practice here tend to identify and label specific emotions, like joy, like sadness, like grief. Then there's a section on the questionnaire on what we call contemplative attitudes. And what this is a rewording in a common sense terms of the basic virtuous and unvirtuous mental factors. Okay, hindrances and virtuous mental factors like faith, confidence, like non-violence, like non-ignorance, like patience, like diligence. And we tried to find out which of these mental factors tend to increase over the months of the practice. And the only ones that turned out to be significant in terms of increase were faith, confidence. And most people over the course of the 3 month practice come with very little confidence. And over the course of the practice increase that mental factor in themselves. That they're confident that even though they don't know the directions of their experience, they can kind of hang in there and just watch what comes up next. And that's sufficient. And they believe that they have the resources in themselves to master the practice. Now, that's a very significant finding, because most people who come in this culture don't seem to have the quality of faith necessary. And that's why a lot of people don't come. That's why you never see them here. But they tend to get that simply by doing the practice. The other virtues that seem to get cultivated over the course of the 3 months were non-harmfulness and non-violence. And that was across the board for most of the people who come here. Some of the others, there were tendencies in certain directions, but not significant. For example, effort, diligence. People varied greatly in the amount to which they learned that in the course of 3 months. Concern, so that they don't go astray in their practice and lose it. People varied greatly in that. The quality of detachment, people varied greatly in that. The implication of that is that setting the foundations by actively cultivating certain virtuous mental factors is something that happens only to a certain extent in 3 months of practice. You get a little bit of knowledge about what faith is, but not a lot beyond that. And that laying the foundations for practice is something that's very hard and takes many years to do. And you only get a little bit of that, even in 3 months of constant effort. It makes me think more of emphasizing the necessity for the foundations and for the virtue practice, in addition to the sitting. I'm going to skip over some of the rest of that, just giving a gloss of some of the different findings that come up. This year we did work with the Rorschach, and we wanted to find out something more about, well, let me tell you the original reason for doing that. We gave that questionnaire out for a number of years in order to find out the common experiences that people had over the course of 3 months. But it became clear to us that people differed, given the same instructions, that people have very different capacities. And we wanted to find out whether or not different people had very, very different kinds of experiences with the same instructions. So one of the things that we did is we went back and looked at people's cognitive style. Some people tend to be more oriented towards thinking and less aware of feelings. Okay. Some people tend to be more in touch with feelings, and the feelings are always turning over, but generally not aware of thoughts, or if they're aware of thoughts, they tend to aware of thoughts in kind of a superficial manner. Okay. So people have very different what in psychology is called a cognitive style. And that's a character structure, and it tends to be fixed. Once you develop a certain orientation or style of thinking, it doesn't seem to change a lot. At least that's what psychologists assume. And even after a number of years of psychoanalysis in this culture, it's shown that people who go through that don't change the character structure a great deal. It seems from our studies with the Rorschach that character structure doesn't change a lot, even through the meditation, and even with advanced meditation. That your basic personality makeup is pretty much the same. What changes is your perspective on that. So the content and structure of who you are is pretty much the same. But your perspective changes drastically, okay? But if you think you're going to end up being a totally different person after many, many years of the practice, it's not true. People will probably still recognize you and know you. Now that's also a constraint, but also a freedom when you think about it. You know? Now Rorschach is one of the ways of measuring character structure, because people have very fixed style of how they approach the inkblots. Do you all know what the inkblots look like? This is a, oops, I don't want that one. This is an example of the inkblot, okay? Now, what I mean by difference in style is that people might look at the whole inkblot, let me hold it up, or people might look at just a part of the inkblot. And there are rather consistent differences in people. Some people more often just look at the whole, and they hardly ever look at the parts. Some people always focus on the little details, and they don't look at the whole at all. So the very style of what people locate, how they pay attention, is pretty consistent, and it doesn't change, even with therapy or even with meditation. It seems to be relatively fixed for adults. So one of the things that we look at is the style of how people perceptually, see, it's a perceptual style, break up the inkblot. Okay? The next thing is what are called determinants, or what people, what about the card makes them focus on certain images. For example, some people might see a bat or a butterfly with this card, right? Well, what makes a person respond with a particular image is somewhat dependent on what's in their head, and somewhat dependent on the stimulus of this little blob or inkblot, right? And people have different sensitivities. Like some people are very sensitive to color, so that they tend to focus on the color more rather than the, you know, the shading here. Some people are very sensitive to shading. Some people are very sensitive to the subtle nuances in the shading. Most people are sensitive to the form or the shape, okay? And there are real differences in, relatively speaking, whether you're more sensitive to the form or to the color or to the shading. Or some people see the cards in some sort of movement. Like this is commonly seen in the center here as a human form reaching up, often as a headless human, but some as a human form reaching up. And some people are very sensitive to seeing people or animals or sometimes inanimate objects on the cards as moving around. Okay? And again, people differ in the in their propensities and the amount of which they see movement or the amount to which they see color or are sensitive to it or shading or just the shape. And that's a character difference. People have different styles. Okay? People who tend to see color, that tends to relate to responsivity to emotions. So the people who tend to see color are more in touch with their emotional life. People who tend to see just form are more in touch with the perception of the world as it is and their thinking about that, but less in touch with their emotional life. And you can look for differences in that kind of thing. That's what we originally had in mind, to look for those stylistic differences and find out whether people answered that long questionnaire differently. Okay? And that there are some definite things you can say about it. What I can say in a very simple way about that, without going into too much detail, well, after doing 3 months of mindfulness meditation, and just leaving the instructions open-ended, that they can focus on whatever content comes up at the exact moment that it arises, you find that different content tends to predominate in different ways for different people. And what we find is that the mindfulness practice tends to amplify whatever your character style is. Okay? So that people who tend to are oriented more towards their thinking tend to report a lot of difficulty with thoughts, or a lot of attention to thoughts early in the practice. And over the course of the weeks and months, tend to be aware of the process of arising of thoughts a great deal during the hour, although they find it to be less problematic. people who tended to be more oriented towards their emotional life tend, not surprisingly, to report a lot of different kinds of emotions coming up in the course of an hour of sitting, right? With a great intensity of the emotions. And their problem tends to be more in not getting so invested in these really intense emotions that are coming up. And over the time, the emotions still come up, but in they can observe them in a less critical, in a more detached way. Just let them be there. But whatever a person's orientation or style, more towards thinking or more towards feeling, the practice tends to enhance that, bring it out more, rather than the opposite. Now, that's the exception to that is sensations, bodily sensations. Everybody, regardless of the character style, gets in touch with bodily sensations. And it's not surprising that bodily sensations would be the first of the four objects of mindfulness, because it really is applicable to all people, pretty much. At least that's what the research seems to show, too. Now, one of the things that we found from some people who've come in here that clinically we would not call that healthy, you might see in a clinic, people who to use diagnostic terms, people who have what's called character disorders, or they have borderline experiences, or people who have schizophrenic illnesses. Every now and then you come up with people who come here and do the practice who clinically seems to us that that's what they their experience is like. What we find about those people is that they generally have a hard time becoming aware of their feelings, emotions, and hard time becoming aware of the bodily sensations. And if you do psychotherapy with people who have those illnesses, that's what you find. They're very much out of touch with their feelings and very much out of touch with the bodily sensations. What we find looking at those people over the course of the months is that they tend to get in touch with the bodily sensations a great deal. And it's the first time they really get in touch with something inside themselves that's really solid. But they don't get in touch with the emotions until much later. Okay? But the practice does seem to work for them in terms of getting them in touch with bodily sensations, and they tend to focus on those as an object and use them a great deal. And over the course of time, when they get comfortable being aware of the bodily sensations, then over time they begin to report emotions much more. And interestingly enough, if you follow these people over time, when they get to the point of being aware of emotions, they tend to get much better. They tend to not have much more difficulty in the work situations or in personal relationships. The problems tend to sort out much more. But it tends to come with some sort of logic. First the bodily sensations, and then the feelings, and then finally their daily life habits tend to get sorted out. Okay? The practice can work. Okay? But they start with a lot of thoughts, and the thoughts are very chaotic and fragmented, and they're very confused and disoriented. But if they focus on the bodily sensations, the practice works for them. Okay? One of the things you learn for that practically, if you have someone coming to a retreat with that kind of problem, give them the bodily sensations as an object. It tends to work more for them. It tends to work quicker for them, rather than if you just leave it open-ended and they get all caught in the thoughts and because they have a hard time just observing the thoughts. Get stuck. Can't do that so easily at first. The other thing that we found that was surprising to us, and we really didn't build this into the original idea of the project, was we gave the Rorschachs after people had been sitting for 3 months. All right. Now, we just thought we would play with that. You know, it wasn't part of the original design. But what we were finding people doing on the Rorschach was so striking that we thought that we better do it to all of the people. So we went back and we tried to get the people who sat originally to do it at the end again. And we got 28 Rorschachs from people before and after the three-month course. And that's a good number. Most Rorschach studies are about 15. So, and the staff also participated in that. So we can compare what happens to the yogis with the staff. Okay. Now, the reason why we added the staff here is that one of the major criticisms of research on meditation in this country was done by a guy named Jonathan Smith, who worked with transcendental meditation. And what he did is he taught people a fake relaxation technique. He told people that if they just sit and try and relax for 20 minutes, that they would get all these gains in terms of reducing their anxiety. Okay, and he taught some teachers that. And he published these fake reports about the research findings, and he convinced the teachers that this was really going to work. The teachers bought it, and then they went out and they taught it. And they showed the students the same fake reports. So that the teachers didn't know that what they were teaching had no validity. Okay? And then the second thing he did is he had another group of teachers that he taught to sit for 20 minutes and be aware of as many thoughts as they could. Think about as much as they could in 20 minutes. The exact opposite of the mindfulness. And again, the teachers thought that that would reduce anxiety. And he compared them over the months, people doing TM, people doing thinking about as many thoughts as possible, and people just trying to relax their body. And he wanted to find out what, if any, of the effects would do to the quality of attention used in TM, what, if any, would do to the just sitting still and relaxing, and what, if any, would do to expectation effects. And what he found is they all reduced anxiety to the same degree with no difference between the populations. The implication being that if you expect the technique to work, it works, even if you don't do the mantra. Okay? Now that's a problem if you're doing meditation research, because you have to pick out what's due to the quality of mindfulness and what's due to the expectation that it's going to work and what's due to the whole environment, living in this kind of environment, hearing the Dharma talks, so forth and so on. So the reason we set up the experiments this way was that the staff live in the same environment, they go to the Dharma talks, and they still practice, okay? But they practice much less during the day. So the major difference between the yogis and the staff is the amount of mindfulness practice, okay? So if you can show a difference between what the yogis do and what the staff does, you can say that those differences are due to the meditation itself, okay? And if there are things that both the staff do and the yogis do, then you can show that those differences are due to the whole getting the teachings and living the environment and expecting the teachings to work in a certain way, but not necessarily due to the quality of mindfulness. So that's why we set it up that way. Okay. Now, we did find some differences, and the differences were rather striking to us. And we found basically three classes of differences. Okay. Now, we had the teachers rate the students in terms of the depth of a depth of concentration that they thought that they got, in terms of the depth of insight that they thought the students got, in terms of the amount to which they thought the students were having a difficult time with the practice or an easy time, and the amount to which the students tended to work with psychological problems, you know, come and just kind of work on whatever, you know, like using it for therapy, okay? Now, interestingly enough, how did you rate those? Did you rate those independently? Did you talk about it?
We didn't talk. We were together when we rated them, and we simply each gave our own
and then
opinion and wrote it
then
down.
And you wrote it down.
That was all. Okay. No discussion.
Well, what you do when you have different people rate something is you find out how much the ratings correlate with each other or consistent with each other. You know, like, does this person on a 10-point scale, does he get a 7 in concentration by one teacher and a 1 by another teacher? Or do they all give 7s? Well, the correlations that you find in most behavioral science research are about, that are considered good, are about 0.4 till about 0.6, 0.7. The range being from 0 means that they're totally off the wall, they don't relate at all, being that they're very consistent 0.99. Now, the teachers' ratings were 0.99 for all of the different things. Now, that's hardly ever happens in behavioral science research. It's really strange.
Suspicious.
Okay? Now, one of the ways of looking at that is in terms of if you work with these students every day over 3 months, you really do get a feel for what they're like and what's going on in them. And it does seem to show pretty clearly by that kind of unusual rating that the teachers really do know where the students are at. Now, the other thing that lends some conviction to that is the fact that if you give that long questionnaire and you ask people to rate where they're at by going out the questions, then their own responses on the questionnaire correlate very highly with what the teachers say. Okay? So if you do it by the person's own awareness of what they're going through or what the teachers say, it tends in the same direction quite strongly. Implication being that both the students and the teachers have some idea of really where they are in the practice. Okay? So it is self-validating, but also observable by others. Now, what we did is we do a kind of analysis called discriminatory analysis. And what you do is you divide the different people up into different groups. Okay? And we broke it up into three groups. First group was what we call the beginners groups. The beginners group are people who tend to work more on psychological issues with the practice over the 3 months. Those are the people that the teachers rated highly as working on psychological issues, and also people who themselves reported a lot of trouble with thinking, emotions, and so forth on the questionnaire. So if you do it two different ways, you tend to get some validity in putting these people in a group of beginners, okay? And they tend to use the practice more for self-therapy. Second group are people who tended to be rated high on concentration by the teachers and tended to answer specific questions on that questionnaire geared towards certain attainments in concentration, like the ability to get a good samadhi. Okay? So we put those in the second group. The third group were people who tended to be rated on high on insight, like insight into impermanence, for example, by the teachers, and tended to answer certain questions about insights on the questionnaire, like impermanence, so forth. We put those in another group. We tried to see whether they had different Rorschachs. And the Rorschachs were strikingly different in all three cases. So much so that I took some of the Rorschachs from the beginners group, some of the Rorschachs from the samadhi group, some of the Rorschachs from the insight group, some of the Rorschachs from people undergoing acute psychotic episodes from the clinic, and Rorschachs from, quote, normal people. I mixed them all up and I gave them to a bunch of clinicians at the medical school. And they were able to sort them out pretty significantly. They were able to tell that those Rorschachs were different, with given very little information about what the nature of the practice was, not having any meditation experience. Tends to think here that if people can really respond in a certain way to these ink blots, then it is a validating something about the practice and really getting at what the practice does. Okay? Now, the beginning Rorschachs, they couldn't tell. And the beginning Rorschachs tend to look like healthy normal Rorschachs to an extent, or not so healthy Rorschachs. But those Rorschachs are pretty much what you'd find if you gave the Rorschach to a bunch of people off the street. If you gave it to 30 people off the street, you gave it to 30 people here who are all beginners in that group, they wouldn't look so different. Not so striking. Okay? The samadhi Rorschachs were very striking. Okay. Now, what do people normally do with the Rorschach? People look at the ink blot, and they tend to make images up, okay? This is a projective test, okay? Which means that you tend to take the images that come up in your mind to the stimuli of this block and project it onto the block. So it might look like a bat or a butterfly, okay? Or the whole card. Or the center might look like a human form. Those are pretty common responses, okay? But you're taking the images that come up in here and you're saying them to the stimuli out here. Now one could take that to the extreme and think that all of this is a projection, okay? And to some extent that's relatively true. But the ink blot measures the extent to which we project onto an ambiguous stimulation, ambiguous stimuli. So it's a good test of perception. It's not what it's used for. It's usually used for a test of character structure. But it's also a very good test of how we project, the process of how the mind works to project content onto the world. This time the world is ambiguous. So most of us make up a series of images. Usually people see two or three images per card. And there are 10 cards in all. Okay? Now what do the people do after 3 months of meditating? Well, to put it very simply, they tend to look at the ink blot and they just see the ink blot. Okay? They don't make up images and they don't associate greatly to it. And most of the people complain that that really wasn't where their mind was at. Okay? It was really hard work to come up with all this stuff. You know? They just wanted to look at the ink blot. Okay? But they didn't say that they just looked at the ink blot. You know? They spent as much time perceptually involved in the ink blot as they did the first time around. What do? They spent a lot of time focusing on the shapes, the edges, the colors, the shading and the nuances as they did making up images the first time. And the raw perceptual data itself was enough and very interesting to them. Okay? Just to read you some of the responses. I just lack the kind of motivation or interest to look at this stuff. I could force things, but that's about it. After 3 months of meditation, it really wiped out my interest in trying to find things. If I decide to engage in it more, it just sends off all these associations. I'm not really interested in these. It's as if all the cognitive layering and motivation are connected somehow. Very interesting insight. When asked if he could tell what the inkblot looked like if he really tried, he said, oh, yes. And he came up with just as many as last time, some of them similar, some of them different. That was the experience of most people doing the test. Okay. To them, the inkblot looked like an inkblot. According to the same subject, the meditation has wiped out all of the interpretive stuff on top of the raw perception. Like, there's this thing out here, but then when I'm asked to make it look like something, I go into it, and then I can get into all the levels of perceptual layering and make stuff up. Okay? But they kept qualifying it. That's really not the kind of experience that they were having. But what was the experience like for them? Well, first of all, it was very fluid, which means they kept turning over the images in their mind. Things would come so quickly. Just to quote from some of the people, it's becoming so many things so quickly, they go before the words come out. It's a lot of things at once. Could be a bat, could be a butterfly, could be a flying man. It's really all those things and more. So there's so much there, it keeps turning over so rapidly, it's hard to pin it down now, okay? What they did instead of pinning it down was to just focus on the pure perceptual features of the inkblot itself. For example, the outline. To quote, one of the things I could focus on is the outline of the blot, the different variations up and down, the little patterns, the little ridges of the blot. And then, oh yeah, now I see human pelvis. So they could come up with things. But the first impact of the blot was just the pure form, okay? Also the color. It's as though more comes from the color. It's a remarkably stronger input, an incredible set of impressions, okay? Also from the shading. Most about this one is the color, the shade, the heaviness of the dark in contrast to the white and the shades of gray. Sometimes the shading moved around. So many quick changes, my focus was somewhere else than the images. It's easier to look at the movement, the vibration, the texture and the movement. Occasionally more obvious forms come up. But what's here, I remember I saw in the pretest. But within the ink itself, there's so much movement. Like sometimes there were these faces and eyes, but they changed so quickly that when I tried to say something, it was no longer there. Right? This illustrates perceptually something about what happens in mindfulness. The content is constantly turning over quickly, and the yogi's attention is right there to pick it up. Okay? And they're just staying with the pure data, the pure perceptual data, not judgmental, not interpretive. Okay? So there's something about this test that's validating, you see, for the kind of experiences that people are having during the practice.
Give me an example.
I see the head of someone who's sitting at the piano. It's funny. I don't really see the piano. It's almost like the posture of the head reminds me of someone who's intently playing the piano. His shoulders and arms feel like they're in the position of someone playing the piano. I see some little tiny dots, shapes of ink of the head, and it reminds me of musical notes. It's like a visual image of the music that's being played. The person has a kind of unkempt hair, as musicians sometimes do. Scraggly hair and a short beard. And I just get the sense of someone who's just playing at a really intense, basically fairly happy kind of music, probably jazz and possibly classical. So you're really going to feel for that. Yeah. Normal people given the Rorschach hardly ever do that. Psychotic people do that a lot. But when psychotic people do that, they ignore the inkblot. They ignore the shape of the inkblot, and they just go on in this whole thing in their head. What the mindfulness people did is that is perfectly attuned with the actual shape on the blot. They never leave that. Okay? So they're matching the quality of their inner world with perfect attunement to what's out there. Okay? In a very rich way. And with a lot of feeling. And that the clinicians in the medical school who judged these, the difference that they felt between the people who had a lot of insight here and what we call normal Rorschachs is that normal Rorschachs are usually given by people who are bright and think a lot, but tend to lose touch with their feelings a lot. But the difference, strikingly, about the people who were giving the insight Rorschachs from here were people who were very, very much not only bright, but in touch with the feelings. They were right there with the feelings as they came up. And in that way, they were much healthier than what we consider normal Rorschachs. And it says something about the quality of the practice, I think. Another style we call the creative style, where a person would look at the form and stay with the shape on the inkblot, but constantly turning over different perspectives of the same thing. Okay? They would look at it from different angles. They would ascribe different emotions to the same percept, and constantly changing their view on it, although staying right with the form. Okay? And that was characteristic, again, of the people who had gotten a lot of insight. Now, let me just comment a bit on these two styles, the samadhi style and the insight style, because it really does seem to be consistent with what the teachings say. Okay? If you have a good concentrative state, you tend to shut off your thinking processes and stay with just what's there. That's exactly what the Rorschach shows. Okay? People who get very good at insight constantly turn over the products in their mind, always watching the process of arising. And what they notice after a while is that they can notice the process by which things come forth much more quickly, and the content goes quicker and quicker and quicker. That's exactly what you're finding here in the Rorschach. Much more content than you do find for normal Rorschachs. It's always turning over, and it's very, very rich. And yet, the quality of awareness is right there with it. Okay? Now, what about the teachers? We did some work with the teachers, and we did some work with some of the... Jack Engler collected Rorschachs from some of the South Asian teachers. And what do they do on the Rorschach? Well, one of the things that was very surprising to us is that the teachers' Rorschachs don't look like the insight Rorschachs that we had expected. We thought they would be very similar to what we found in the insight Rorschachs from people. They're not like that. As a matter of fact, the teachers' Rorschachs don't look so different from what we would consider healthy, normal Rorschachs. They're very much like a regular Rorschach, with one major difference, that every one of the teachers' Rorschachs at times had certain references to other realms of reality on them. Like whether it be the different beings from the different realms, or whether it be awareness of energy currents and things within the body. So there's kind of an expansion of awareness beyond personal view of oneself to include all of the realms and times to some degree. And that comes up every now and then on the Rorschach. But outside of those episodic kind of references, the Rorschachs from the teachers don't look so different from normal Rorschachs. Now what does it mean? Okay, I don't know exactly what it means, but I think we can fit it in the context of the practice. During concentration, you shut off all the higher thinking processes and concentrate your mind down. That makes sense, that's what the Rorschachs say. During the insight series of meditations, you're watching the process of arising events occur much more quickly, arising and passing away, arising and passing away very quickly. That's what the Rorschachs tend to show. After enlightenment, your mind does not look so different from normal waking mind. The ordinary mind is pretty much there, but your perspective is very different on it. And it doesn't seem surprising that Rorschachs from the teachers would be very similar to ordinary waking mind Rorschachs, with some very different views, a very different perspective taken on it. Okay? Now, some of the South Asian teachers, very interesting. One of the South Asian teachers that I wanted to mention briefly did a very strange thing we've hardly ever seen on the Rorschach. But most people give you 1, 2, 3 responses per card, and that's it. And usually the responses are very different. Okay? This particular teacher gave 1, 2, 3 responses per card to the first card. Then, given the second card, the teacher gave you 2 or 3 more responses. Given the third card, the teacher gave you 2 or 3 more responses. But every one of those responses was integrated into a systematic unfolding of the teaching. Okay? Card one started out with a view of the world and the condition of the world of suffering. Human beings were suffering in the card, and animals were suffering in the card. So card one was laying out the scenario of samsara. Card two gave a description of the mind state of hatred that caused that. Card three gave a description of the beings in hell that were the consequence of that. Okay? Now that indicates, again, something about introducing karmic theory into the teachings through the Rorschach. Card 4 and 5 gave ignorance and desire as other mind states. Okay? Card 6, there's a kind of a central post in the card, was seen as the pillar of the mind that can be yoked to correct that. And then cards 8 and 9 showed some of the perceptions of the teaching as it unfolded. A very systematic unfolding of the teaching. And yet integrating all the responses into that, it's pretty hard to pull that off. Okay? Okay? Now you can, every now and then you see a person who's very paranoid, who will give you a number of relate to the other cards, you know, remember back to the other card and integrate it somehow into their delusional system. Okay? But what's different about the way this particular teacher did it was that all of the responses were integrated, without exception. I've done a lot of work with paranoids, and I've never seen a paranoid person integrate like that. Okay? Also, that the responses were congruent with the shape of the ink block, you know. With paranoid, they're just usually off the wall. They just ignore the shape of the ink block. Okay? So this person was very attuned to the reality and fitting the teachers very much attuned to the reality at hand and coming up with their own mind state, if you will, to meet the reality at hand. Okay? We call that an integrative style of Rorschach. We never seen it ever in any clinical population, a healthy population in this country, with one exception. I've seen Rorschachs like that from a study that was done by Bryce Boyer. He's a psychiatrist in San Francisco who studied Apache shamans. And he had the shamans, he divided the shamans into what the Indians themselves thought were real shamans and who they thought were fake shamans. And the fake shamans Rorschach looked like clinical Rorschachs as we see them, not very good, you know. The healthy Rorschachs, most of them did this kind of thing. Most of them, from the real shamans, did this integrative style. And we found it again with the teachers. It might be an artifact. We don't have enough data from different teachers to do this. But it might also indicate a very profound integrative capacity of different realms and different kinds of experience. And then bringing that forth to the situation at hand. And we found that only in some of the South Asian teachers. That gives you an overview of some of the things we've been finding from this. I think maybe I talked much too long. I'll just open it for questions and for Jack and Joseph, if anyone wants to respond.
You said you divided the Rorschachs between the staff and the three-month yogis.
Yeah.
To isolate the effect of the practice of mindfulness. And what was the conclusion about that? Versus just the total experiment.
The staff first of all, there's a problem with that. Most of the staff who had been veteran meditators, so they were already, because they had been long-term meditators, were already coming up with some of the more advanced effects that we were seeing. So it wasn't a good population in that sense, you know, where a lot of the people who come in 3 months were beginners. So it's not clean data. And it was very clear-cut, even in the pre-testing of the staff, you know, that they had a lot of experience with it. You could see it on the Rorschachs, you could see it on the questionnaires. For the people who weren't veteran meditators, generally you find a tendency in the same direction as the three-month people, but much less intense. Okay? And I think it has to do very simply with the intensity of practice, the amount of effort you put into it. But they go in the same direction. Hence, what we conclude from that is that most of the effects seem to be due to the practice of the mindfulness, and not simply the expectation effects. Expectation effects you find much more for people on shorter courses, like 2 weeks, who just come and they, you know, zip in and zip out, and then they, you know, they think that the meditation has changed their life, but they don't keep up with it. That's when you get much more expectation effects. You hardly see a lot of that in the 3 months. When you're here for that long, you know, you tend to root out all that.
Have you done any testing with 3 months, say 6 months after they've completed the course and they've gone outside?
Well, we'd like to do a follow-up with the Rorschach study with people who are around a year from that. We did do follow-up on some of the attitude studies, some of the affect studies, and they tend to stick. Yeah.
Did you say that women have better concentration because they seem to practice it more, because you
see
that effect somewhere?
No, just seems to be a natural propensity. Not a
crowd. See that somewhere else in the testing?
In the questionnaire. Do we see it elsewhere?
Did you see it in the workshop?
No.
So
we haven't given enough other tests to find that out.
Or that you see somewhere that they have better concentration?
If you take the general overall population and you divide it half male, half female, you know, more women tend to be better concentrators than men. Okay, but there's some women who aren't. Because they answer all the questions on the concentration part that tend to key for that. Their own report is that they're better concentrators. Now whether that would be true on some objective measures, we haven't done those tests yet. You know. That would be easy to do, actually. there was a correlation that we found, a rather strong correlation between degree of concentration and amount of insight. Okay, and that was maybe something to be said about the teaching of this. That people who tend to develop a certain moderate range of concentration tend to get further with their insights in 3 months. People who tend to not work on the concentration and de-emphasize it and who aren't very concentrated tend to get initial insights, like they get some insight into impermanence, but they don't go beyond that. So it's a plateau effect. And the moral of the story seems to be that you do need to emphasize the concentration to build a foundation somewhat for the practice. And if you don't do that after a certain time, you tend to plateau off and don't get much further. Would you say that's true? On the other hand, you know, like you were saying, it's a mixed bag, because you know, if you focus too much on the concentration, then you don't get the insight. So which way do you go with it? It's tricky. How to find a balance between those two.
I would want to offer a criticism in that the person that tested me at the end of the retreat was not a meditator. And I was inclined to give process comments on the workshop, and he was steering me away from that. You know, he was saying, well, you're supposed to give images, that's the way workshops go.
It's a valid criticism. But yet the findings turn out to be more significant because of that criticism. You see, I brought up people to do the Rorschachs with me who have no experience in meditation. It didn't tell them anything about the project ahead of time. The reason for that is to guard against experimental bias, which means if I'm the only one doing the Rorschachs and I have some commitment to the practice, how much of what I'm finding is because I'm cueing the people to respond in certain ways. If I bring up a bunch of people who don't know anything about what I'm doing, they don't know anything about meditation, and they find the same thing, you see, it does seem to suggest that it's not simply my own biases. That's why we did it that way. Now, it turns out that if people can come up with just the pure perceptual form and not the images, even when the task and the experimenter is telling them to do something opposite, that's quite a feat, okay? And it makes the findings even more significant, simply because it was arranged that way. Under other conditions that were more freewheeling, yeah, you probably would have seen less images and more of the form, and more of the raw data that was there. Still, that it came out that way makes it more, because you have to overcome the whole task. And you know how people like to kind of go along with what the experimenter wants to a certain degree. Most people do that in experiments. They're very obliging. The fact that they didn't do that to a great degree says something very, very profound about the nature of the research. But I think your criticism is certainly well taken. It's harder to do it, and it's frustrating to take the Rorschach under those conditions when your experience is not that way.
Did you check for a correlation between student lifestyle preferences and teacher lifestyle preferences on that list of 13 lifestyles?
I haven't done that yet. We could. I just don't have any sense of it.
I think that for this afternoon we've taken enough time. I'm really grateful to hear some of this. It's interesting and useful, and hopefully it will continue to be more useful, not just to people who are practicing and teaching, but also to make meditation tools and understanding accessible to psychiatrists and psychologists and people who could well use them in this culture. And I appreciate that it was an enormous amount of work that Dan's done in coordinating and analyzing the data. So thank him for that.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/ donate.